Welcome to the Work-Life Balance Project. Hi everyone, this is Steven Olson, your host, and you're here on the Work-Life Balance Project, where we uncover how working parents manage to succeed in their career without sacrificing their family. This week's interview is with a longtime friend of mine, Christy Gleason. She's an accounting professor at the University of Iowa and a mom to three kids. The way she thought about work-life balance was forced to change when her husband Rick passed away from leukemia in 2008. Despite the immense challenge that was for her and her young family, she has continued as a successful professor and an incredible mom. With that, we'll get to the interview. Christy, thanks so much for being on the Work-Life Balance Project. We're really excited to have you. Can we just get to know you a little bit? What do you do now? Where do you live?
Sure. So I'm an accounting professor at the University of Iowa. So we live in Iowa City, Iowa. And I have been at the University of Iowa for 14 years now. And I have three kids, and they range from almost 12 years old to 19.
Wow. Yeah, that's great. And so your oldest is in college, right?
She is.
And your youngest is just...
She's finishing grade.
That's great. That's a nice range. You've been parenting for a long time. You've been in the business a long time.
Yeah. I'm not sure with hindsight if that's the ideal or the non-ideal, but that's how it worked out. So,
tell me a little bit about before the kids came around. What was your life like?
What was my life like before the kids came around? That's a long time ago, 19 years ago. Let's see. So when we got married, I had finished my master's degree in accounting and was applying to PhD programs. And my husband had just finished his engineering degree. And we ended up moving to Ithaca, New York, which is where I did my PhD.
Where did you two meet?
At BYU.
At BYU, okay.
We lived in the same apartment complex for a little while. And I want to say it's the Riviera. Is that the right name?
Oh, yeah. That is, yeah.
Yeah. And so probably in what is not a good example of work-life balance, Rick had his first bone marrow transplant the first year of my PhD program. And he didn't actually arrive until the last year, the fifth year of my PhD program. She was born 3 weeks before my first interview.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so was it a total surprise when you found out that Rick...
Oh, so I think... So maybe because we were... Maybe because of that bone marrow transplant, we felt like we had given up a lot of control over those options. So I think the doctor's first response was, you probably won't have kids without using IVF. And that seemed really stressful. We had friends who were in the middle of that route. And boy, there was a lot of tears and, I don't know, insanity on hormone levels. And so that all seemed like a bad mix with the PhD program. And so we just thought we would tackle that when I was done. And so when we found out we were pregnant, I think the doctors were a little bit surprised and I was surprised and my dissertation chair was super surprised.
So was that really hard at first? I'm sure you were working a lot and it was really stressful. And then you also had a baby to start worrying about.
Yeah, I mean, it was a little... Rick was working as a civil engineer and my first interview was 3 weeks. It wasn't... She was late. It wasn't supposed to be 3 weeks away, but it turned out to be 3 weeks away. But that I got that job offer, so I must not have screwed it up too badly.
That's good.
It was a little bit stressful, and then you just sort of start trying to figure out how are you going to manage this? And... PhD programs are pretty flexible, and then when I graduated, I took a job at the University of Arizona, and Rick quit working as a civil engineer and stayed home to take care of Annie. You know, so you start trying to figure out what's our best set of options for this, and so that's the one we picked.
Yeah. So what were the factors that played into that decision? That's a, you know, it's not a traditional decision.
Yeah. So maybe three things. So probably the first thing that weighed, I'm not even sure what weighed the most heavily. I mean, we thought about it a lot. We got a lot of counsel and a lot of feedback. So the three things that we weighed, one of them was Rick's health. So he'd had a bone marrow transplant, and you can't really get a PhD in accounting and not do anything with it and then go back to it. And you know, I don't know what will happen with insurance and Affordable Care Acts and things like that, but most insurance, at least up until now, has been tied to your employment. And, you know, so you start thinking about, okay, well, how would we manage health problems long run? And me being the primary earner in my insurance solves some of those problems, because it, you know, you can manage longer term treatments or hospitalizations without a glitch. So that was one factor. Rick did not really love being a civil engineer. He had put himself through school as a photojournalist, and I think he was sort of thinking, okay, well, I would go back and do something different, you know, when the kids are out of school. So that's not, it's not an impediment to my career, and I can do some of this even with the kids. So that was another factor. And then I think the third factor that we sort of weighed is just what kept the most options open. What sort of kept the most options open for both of us to be able to do things that we enjoyed, and to have our children have the kind of parenting we wanted them to have, i.e. not have a lot of babysitters, which you would get with both of us working. And right. That seemed like it kept the most options open.
So you started working in Arizona, the University of Arizona.
Yeah.
And he started at first with just one at home. Is that right?
Yeah.
And was it, do you think it was easy for him? Did he?
No.
It wasn't?
I think it was a little bit stressful. I had to learn not to micromanage. The way he did it was just fine.
What were some of the things that you wanted to micromanage?
What she ate, what time the nap was, but you know, I really quickly figured out that what she wore, I definitely wanted to micromanage.
I mess that up all the time. Yeah.
What? Also, I was far more conscientious about there needing to be pictures and outfits for certain people, like, you know, as they grew into the gift clothing, you know, and he was just oblivious to that. I mean, we blew through several things without my aunts getting pictures or whatever.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You don't have that problem with the second or third child, but the first child, you sort of feel like you owe these people, you know, I don't know.
That's true.
Yeah, I think it was a little bit of an adjustment. Both when we moved to Ithaca and again when we moved to Arizona, I think the bigger adjustment was just being different. When we moved to Ithaca and when we went to church that first week, it's mostly a college student ward congregation, and almost everybody that introduced themselves to us asked him what he was studying. And that was a long day for him. And then, you know, that same thing was true when we moved to Arizona. What do you do? Well, you know, Chrissy's a professor at the University of Arizona. It was just a long, you know, I think that was sort of a long sort of day.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, a couple months of sort of figuring out.
Right.
Because, you know, we had a set of friends in Ithaca, and he had a set of friends he did things with, and then you move and you have to sort of restructure all of that.
Right.
On top of being sort of non-typical. Yeah, so that was a little bit, it was a little rough.
Yeah, how did he find people how did he find friends? That would be tough.
So he started taking, he started taking a watercolor painting class, and it turns out that there are always people that want to golf in Tucson. We had money for babysitters, so I don't, so he had the flexibility to be gone for an hour or two, or, you know, to go do things. But I think it was a little more work, just because you're not typical, yeah.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah. And, but did you ever get any really weird comments from people about it, or was it mostly just...
Really weird? No, I mean, we got a few judgmental comments.
Yeah, like what?
Well, I mean, certainly in our church culture, there was sort of this perception from some people that I was just some feminist liberal woman who didn't understand her place, and that, you know, that he was just some slacker or something, which isn't really true. He has a degree in civil engineering. It's a little hard to be a slacker in that field.
Right.
He worked as a bridge design engineer, but, you know, that's not what he would say. Even when we moved here to Iowa, I mean, there's always a little bit of that. There was always a little bit of that. We probably have this set of friends we have in both places more because those are the people that didn't sort of have those perceptions. They were like, oh, great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. So you worked in Arizona for a little while, and then where did your kids come, and where did you move, and how did that story play out?
Yeah, I worked at the University of Arizona for 5 years, and William was born I guess we were there for about 3 years before he was born. And because he was he would be almost two when we moved to Iowa. And then we got a phone call from the University of Iowa. They had lost a couple faculty. They were looking to hire. They have a really well-ranked department in what I do. And did I want to come visit for a year? Because they were too late to hire, but they could bring me in as a visitor with the intention of hiring me. So it was kind of it was about a 6 month long interview, which was a little bit stressful.
It is stressful.
It was a little stressful. So we moved here, and Annie started kindergarten here, and I got a job offer in early December, and we took it. And Kate was born, I guess, 2 years later. Yeah, so we were here for about 2 years before Kate was born. And my boss, when I went in to tell him I was pregnant, said, "You're having another child." Like, what? You're having another child? I should get the inflections right. What?
So did
you're having another child? Something like that.
So how much time did you get off between kids and things like that?
Yeah, so a good thing about being a professor is that you definitely have to deliver your classes when they're scheduled. But you don't have nearly as much structure around 8 to 5 things. But because classes are on the semester, universities also, we've gotten better, but certainly that's largely because more women have said your policies are a little bit poor. Let's see. With Annie, I was a PhD student, so I interviewed 3 weeks later, so you can infer that there wasn't a lot of break. With William, my department head was great, and so William was born in September. My department had rearranged all my teaching so that I had that whole semester off.
Oh, wow.
And then Kate was born in June, and I was back in the classroom in August.
Wow.
Yeah.
And
But, you know, I mean, I would say I probably delivered my classes that August, but I probably wasn't in the office on the days I wasn't teaching or whatever, which is sort of how we managed it.
Gotcha. That was going to be my question. Were you able to make your schedule pretty flexible to be able to spend time at home?
So for the most part, in my field, most of us teach 2 days a week, and most of us only teach one semester. So you teach all your classes in one semester so that you have the other semester off to do research. And that both helps and hurts around maternity schedules. So the good news is that I just had to teach. But I was untenured, so it's not like you feel like you could not do research, because there's a clock running. And you have a certain amount of time to get publications, to get tenure. And there's not, you know, they add a year when you have a baby, but it sucks a lot of time. So it's not like you feel like, oh, I can just kick back here for a year and then I can make this all work. But I was only teaching 2 days a week, and, you know, so I was pretty tired on the end of those 2 days, but you could sort of ease up the other days to make that manageable.
That's nice.
I mean, it had its ugly moments, but there's a few days I can remember thinking, this is going to kill me, but
So that's an interesting comment on that topic. Do you ever, what have been some of the biggest challenges about working and, I guess maybe we should explain. So now you are
full-time
both ways, right?
So Kay was born in 2005, and then my husband's leukemia recurred in 2006, and he passed away in 2008. And so, so now I manage things with just me. So probably the worst thing is just, so I have a lot of flexibility, which is really good, but pretty high demands that go with the flexibility. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while, you're sort of overscheduled to where you can't figure out where the slack's going to come from. And I think that's probably when you think, this might kill me, you know? Can you die from lack of sleep? I don't know. Maybe you can.
Do you remember any of those specific moments?
Sure. So I think one of the questions that was on your guide was something about, you know, are there mistakes you've made? And they almost go hand in hand. So, you know, how much can you commit to doing for other things? So this is before Rick died. I sewed a Sleeping Beauty costume that Annie wanted. I couldn't find one in the stores that was what she wanted, that was Aurora's dress, that looked like it belonged on a small child. And so I sewed it. And oh my gosh, what was I thinking? You know, but that same thing has showed up multiple times. Like, they want a Halloween costume that takes a little bit of extra work, or the school doesn't have enough volunteers for the Halloween party, and I have made brooms out of string cheese and pretzels and goblin eyes out of, I don't even remember what now, like till late into the night, because they, you know, there just weren't enough parents signing up, and so I said, sure, I can get that done, and I probably shouldn't have done that. So I think that would be an example of just trying to do all the things you think you might do. Like, I think if I were a stay-at-home mom, I would make sure my kids have the Halloween costume they want to have, and I would be super supportive at the school party. And so, you know, you try and deliver that same level of, home life sort of thing that you think they would have. And on the other side, I think sometimes I've just overestimated what I can agree to do. So I've said yes to one more conference or, one extra day of travel or something. And one of those, there have been a couple, they seem to be a lot in October. There have been a couple of those Halloweens that between the school thing and the traveling thing, I just thought, oh my gosh, I will never learn. This is really bad. you miss stuff too. I mean, I've laid out all the costumes as I headed out the door with my suitcase and left that for someone else to do with some regret, you know, but I was sort of past the back out point, and so it was just done. So I think that committing, sometimes it's just hard to anticipate how much time things will really look like on the calendar, and it's not quite where you would line it up if you could see what it was going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you think your kids have adapted to that? And how do you think maybe your kids are raised differently because of the situation that they've been in?
Yeah. So their experiences are really different. So Annie was 10 when Rick died, and William was 5, and Kate was 2. So I think all Kate really knows is babysitters. Like, I don't think she can remember that her dad was home.
Because he was in the hospital so much?
He was in the hospital, and I think she's too young to remember before that at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only thing she really remembers about the hospital are things other people have told her. William remembers a little bit, and then, so Annie would be the one who has sort of the two sets. So I think they have to be a little bit more independent. And by independent, I mean, they get themselves up in the morning. They, for the most part, keep track of things they need and know how to ask about what they need. And they know that getting stuff on the calendar matters.
Are these things that you've had to teach them and sort of demand of them, or do you feel like they've been able to pick it up?
Oh, that's a good question. So I remember being out of town once and calling home and Rick not being there. So this would be like before cell phones, or maybe right early in cell phones. I don't remember. But Annie had, she had done this homework assignment that she was supposed to do in pencil in pen and had made a mistake. And so he had been busy trying to help her white it out, make a clean copy of it, and do it, because she had gotten really agitated about having done it wrong. And I said, you know, she could have just lived with that. And he said, well, I'd like her to at least think that to some extent her parents can backstop her when things aren't going quite right. So I tried to maintain not the perpetual, like, if you forget your instruments all the time, people run them to school for you or whatever. But I've tried to make sure that they don't just feel like we have no backstop, you know, that their parental resources are so constrained. So I try and use calendars a lot and go over the calendars, you know, the weekly calendar we go over on Sunday, the daily calendar we go over every evening, like, okay, so everybody knows this is what's on the plate, that sort of thing. And so they all made their lunches pretty early. The girls all did their hair. I don't know if I insisted or demanded it, but I don't know that I left a lot of alternatives. So, I mean, there are screw-ups. There are days where it doesn't happen, you know, where there are weeks where it doesn't happen. But I think without a lot of... Without a lot of discussion, everybody understands you can't maintain that week of screw-ups, and it sort of gets back on pace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really good advice. I like the calendar idea. I bet Hannah would love it if I would be more on top of those things.
Yeah, there's the electronic calendar. I have a Google Family calendar that they can all see on their Google accounts, and there's one on the wall.
That's helpful.
That sometimes uses red.
What were some of the, if you don't mind me asking, some of the things while Rick was in and out of the hospital a lot? I mean, I can imagine that was a huge strain on time because you were still working, right? And and there was obviously everything that needed to be done at home, and you wanted to spend time with him. So how was that time like as a family, and what did you do to make it through?
Okay, so he was diagnosed, the leukemia recurred, and they found it in November of 2006. And he had outpatient treatment for, something like 8 months, including one bone marrow transplant. So he was in and out of the hospital a little bit, like when he had infections, he'd have to stay overnight, but not a whole lot. So we, that's the first babysitter I hired. And so she would come in, I think she came in 3 days a week, and she helped out with Kate. And his doctor's appointments were usually on those days. So the great thing about the community where I live is the vast supply of overqualified spouses of students, and there just aren't enough jobs for all these qualifications, right? So my good friend Eric Anderson found me one of these spouses, and that was really great. So she would come in, and she would help out with Kate. She was here probably until about, like, I'm going to say she was here like 9 to 4 or something like that. So not a huge, not every day, but she started coming in and doing some of that. And then he went into the hospital in August of 2007, and he was there. So for what turned is about 6 months until he died. And that, I think that was a little bit more of a mix. So, so I reevaluated my babysitting, and Kate actually went to somebody's house, and the primary reason was she was about 2, and she was home all day with a babysitter. And even with the best of intentions, it's so hard to get them to, not just sit around all day. So I found somebody that had a child about Kate's age who had one older child and was really calm, Emily Norby. And she was great. So she watched Kate every day. I dropped her off after I dropped the kids off. And so Kate had somebody who was about, I think, closer to somebody to play with and somebody who sort of kept things on a more balanced scale. And I didn't have a babysitter in my house again until Kate went to school, because this was, you know, till Kate went to preschool, because it would just be Kate at home with the babysitter, and that wasn't very good. And then I would go back and forth during the day between my teaching job and the hospital. And then the kids and I would usually go up in the early afternoon, and then we'd go home and have dinner. And after they went to bed, somebody from my church, so there were a set of about five women, they had a rotating schedule, and they would come over to the house at about 8:30 at night after the kids were in bed. And I'd go back to the hospital until 10 or 10:30. And I think, honestly, initially I thought we just have to get through this. And then, you know, one of these bone marrow transplants will be successful. And so it's not like I started with a permanent solution. I just kept sort of gluing it together in some fashion.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there was a permanent solution, or...
It looks a lot like the solution we have after he dies, except for the ladies coming over at 8:30 at night, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, but it looks a lot like that sort of solution, which is, you know, trying to balance. For the most part, for the last few years, I try and get home in time to fix dinner, and then I usually have to get some work done after everybody's wound down for the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that allows me to walk out when I need to, and then I pick back up the other things, you know, later at night. And I actually used to take work back down to the hospital, so I would just sit there and work on whatever. But yeah, so we had a lot of help. I mean, the schools were great. The babysitter was great. Let's see, William was in kindergarten, Annie was in third grade. We had really good teachers. There was a lot of help, yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing that all the stories of help. What, I mean, I've met your kids, they're amazing, and I think they're all great, and they're bright, and they're fantastic. And so what did you do to pull your family together after Rick passed away?
I didn't really have to restart anything. That's a big factor. So some of that's due to Annie. I mean, there are a lot of things that were just habitual about how life went. You know, you do homework, you practice your instrument, you do your job. And I've had mixed success with some things, but a lot of things were just a habit. You know, everybody gets up to have family prayer in the morning. And we usually read scriptures in the morning, and I didn't have to, start that. I just had to maintain it. I didn't have to start family home evening. I just had to maintain it. My kids were probably better. You know, the babysitters had mixed success at enforcing the do your homework and practice your instruments, depending on how much of a spine they had. You know, because, I mean, it takes some negotiation and some... Yeah, they had mixed success.
Right.
But I think for the most part, that's probably where Annie's sort of track record really helps, because she was a good student and she did her homework. And so the other two sort of understood that you do your homework and, you know, they're not flawless at it. I have a good degree in nagging, so.
That's good.
I'm a professional nagger with, you know, sufficient hours to qualify, but... I think a lot of it helped that we had some of that in place. So probably the two things that have been maybe that have required the most sort of, I don't know, adjustment as they've gotten older. There just weren't as many electronics in the world when Rick died. And I've had to put those rules into place all on my own.
Yeah.
And force them with a babysitter sort of trying to enforce it for you. And I feel like that's like a running battle.
That would be really hard. I didn't think about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think when he died, you know, around the time that he died, I think I didn't have a smartphone, and I'm sure I bought my first iPad after he died, but I did have an iPod.
Uh-huh.
And we had a computer and a laptop. So now we own 3 laptops, 1 desktop, 2 tablets, 3 smartphones. It's a lot. There's a lot more. I don't know, parenting around that I've had to both do and then enforce through the babysitter, which is trickier.
That is really tricky. Yeah, I'm just trying to imagine myself as a babysitter, and that would be really hard to enforce that, because you want to be the fun babysitter, and
yeah, you do not want to be the babysitter that kicks them off of everything.
Right.
Yeah.
That's tough. So. As far as your career, where do you see yourself going in the future, and how do you think your family impacts you in your career?
Yeah, okay, so when I started at the University of Arizona, I think I thought I would have to balance things out, but I didn't really feel like my family was, that there were a lot of trade-offs. So I thought of work-life balance maybe at that point as just trying to make sure that I kept some reasonable boundaries. Because I, you know, you have this 10-year clock running. So it's not really a 40-hour a week job. It's a little bit more like a 50 or 60-hour a week job. You just have a lot of control over when you do it.
Mm-hmm.
But you certainly have this propensity because this clock is running. I certainly have colleagues that are pouring a lot of hours into this. So, you know, I felt like the thing I had to do in that phase of my life was keep things in perspective. And so that didn't really change when we moved here. It was a good job opportunity for me. Iowa City had great schools, so you couldn't really turn your nose up at the opportunities that afforded the kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, great community. There's a lot of really good things about living here, which is probably a lot of the reason we still live here. But what changed after Rick died is that there really were more constraints. You know, so one of the things I realized, maybe in part it's because I hire out a lot of things, you know, cleaning ladies and yard work and all kinds of things, that to some extent work-life balance discussions are a little bit of a luxury good. Like, they're this thing that you have the ability to talk about because it doesn't take all your hours to provide necessities. Like, it's a little bit of a luxury good. Like, you have, and it only comes up when I think you think about it because you're worried about the balance, because you feel like you have the ability to control the balance. I suspect this is not a discussion that people who are working the same hours I'm working just to pay the rent ever, you know, have. So, to me, the difference is all of a sudden there were a lot more constraints. And so I actually had to, instead of maybe running with a little bit less sleep and maybe being a little bit careful about my time balance, I actually had to say no to things. So I had to look at things and just say, that's probably something I can't do, or at least I can't do as well as I wanted to do it. So I think academics are often trying to balance, you know, being good teachers and good researchers. And you're always trying to make sure, ultimately, the research matters more for being promoted and hired and tenured. And you're just trying to keep that balance in place. And I didn't feel very much tension between those two things until Rick died. And then I felt like, you know, every hour of committee service or every extra hour of teaching working at the kids' schools or whatever, all those things, you actually hit some point where you say there are more things than even efficiency can, you know, where you actually have to choose. Which is why I'm sort of saying, that's why I think it's kind of a luxury good, right? You're like, when you need all those hours of work to provide the basics of life, this just isn't even a conversation you get to have, but you have the ability to choose. And so then you sort of weigh, well, what is it that I value, and does this map into it? And you're always aware that there are people that are able to make or choose to make a different, a choice that enables them to do something that you're having to say no to.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that takes, I joke sometimes that you become the grand master of mediocrity. Your trade-off is I can keep these things on my plate and do them maybe not as well, or I can shed more things and, you know, just do some of these things really well. But shedding things is painful. And, you know, I can do a lot. You know, I don't play the organ if anyone that plays better than me is in the room. But when they're not there, I'm good enough, uh-huh. You know, but I'm not great at it. And I play the piano well enough. And I don't know. There's lots of things that I think I do them well enough. You know, I'm an okay teacher in the classroom. I think sometimes I'm better and sometimes I'm not, but I do it well enough. I'm a pretty good researcher. I'm a pretty good dissertation chair, but you sort of make trade-offs because you don't always have all the time you would put on to, you know, really excelling at some of those things.
Right. You kind of have to depend on comparative advantage for, to get things done and to do things well.
Yeah. And some things, and you have to let other things go because you say, okay, this does have to be done at a little bit better level. And, you know, so you get better at saying no.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I title the podcast, The Work-Life Balance Project, because I think that that's how people frame it in their mind, right? That,
yeah.
That it's a balance between work and life. But I do feel like that gives an unfair and often an incorrect framework for thinking about how it actually works, because it's not like you need to keep it perfectly weighted on each side. There are some times where one has to pick up, one weighs a lot heavier than another, right? And that's what I'm realizing as I talk to people, that's okay. You know, I think that's okay.
Right.
It's not the
physics definition of balance, but it matches the weights you wanted it to have, like.
Right. And I think a lot of the time when people with families think about work-life balance, what they're really trying to think about is, how can I do what I want to do in my career and feel like I accomplished something and be, you know, as ambitious as I want to be or be as successful as I'd like, and also not leave my family in the dust, right? And make sure that my kids grow up to be good citizens and have morals and that I, you know, communicate with my family and do well there. And so I like what you said. I think that that's really, that puts it in a good perspective that you can't do everything. Do you feel like...
No, but I don't think it feels unbalanced. You just say no. Yeah.
Do you feel like you're a more productive professor because of your family?
So it's interesting when I looked at that question. So you may or may not be aware that in general, these sort of surveys of how employers perceive people, there's a gender bias. So they perceive men with families as being more diligent and efficient and harder working.
Huh.
And they perceive women with families as being less reliable and less committed. And yeah, so this is like a chronic sort of gendered problem.
Wow.
that women face professionally is, so a CPA partner that I know tells a story about a time she took a phone call. There was a partners meeting. She took a phone call. The meeting was running long. People were yakking. And at about 5:10, there's a phone call. She walks out to take it and she doesn't come back to the meeting. And the next day, the managing partner sees her and says, "Is everything okay at home?" And she looks at him confused. And he's like, "Well, I assumed that phone call you got yesterday was some issue at home." She said, "No, it was a client. I had a client meeting I was supposed to take." You know, but his first assumption was, oh, the woman has to go take care of her family when, you know, she's running out to work.
Uh-huh.
So I'm very aware that I think having constraints forces you to having constraints you choose, things you actually value. which I think is how most of us would describe our families, forces you to optimize around them. But I do notice that my colleagues who don't have the same family commitments that I have, I don't know if they're, not all of them, I wouldn't say all of them or even most of them are less efficient. But they have a different set of sort of goals and constraints around which they optimize. And I think it's the constraints that cause you to, which might be your career aspirations. You know, I really want this thing that takes 100 hours. I'm going to pour the 100 hours in, and I still want to, you know, have time for these other things. So I'm going to get super efficient to all my other things. But what I think it does is it forces me to make maybe more efficient choices about what's good enough. Mm-hmm. You know, probably the best piece of advice I got was from one of my faculty members who told me to start prepping for class late in the afternoon the day before. And his argument for that is, prepping for class will take all the time. This is a task that can expand to fill all the time you want to let it fill. So you have to constrain it down into the, you know, end of the day before, so that all you will be able to do is what can be done in that amount of time, and that will force you to be more efficient. I think that's sort of the way family stuff works, right? If you were trying to get home and get to things, you make a different set of choices about how to finish jobs or do them because you have this hard constraint on, I want to go home. I want to be there for dinner. I want to be there to put my kids to bed. I want to make their sporting activities. I want to be at the concert. And those things all force you to say, this is going to be good enough. This is an efficient means to the end. And so I don't know if they make you, I don't know if employers would say, oh, this makes her so much more efficient. But I think it forces me to make a set of choices that get the job done, but maybe I might do it differently if I had, if my time resources were infinite. In the same way that if I started prepping 2 days before for my class, there would be a lot more, you know, fireworks and sound effects.
Right. I think that's really insightful, though. I like thinking about constraints that you choose to put on yourself, and they make you, they kind of shape what you're able to do and how well you do things. It's a really insightful way to think about it.
I'm an accountant. We constrain a lot of things.
Yeah, that's true. So what kinds of things do you like to do with your family to unwind and to spend time together?
When I looked at that question on the paper, I didn't like it any more than I do now.
Oh, well, sorry. You don't have to answer it then.
We usually eat dinner together, and
that's great.
Everybody a chance to talk and chat. And probably on the list of things that are, so it, you know, when your kids are older, they stop wanting to go anywhere with you. And, but they will happily go to concerts, and, you know, we went and saw Pirates of Penzance at the Hancher Theater last week. And, we like to travel, and one of the ways that I manage my life is we go out to eat, and they're good little restaurants. Attenders, so
got a fine palate.
Yeah, well, all but one of them.
Okay, so last question. I always end with this question. What is one replicable thing that you do to find harmony between the demands of your work and the needs of your family?
Yeah, I know the answer to this one. I pay for stuff. So I think one of the smartest things you can do is figure out what you value with your time to price it out. And that's not inconsistent in my mind with my belief that work-life balance is a little bit of a luxury good.
Right.
You know, so I have a cleaning lady, and that frees up time. And I will order groceries delivered because that buys me an hour. And I will pick up dinner I'll either pick up dinner or we'll go out to dinner because it frees up that prep time, but still allows everybody to sit and chat and have dinner, you know, be on an even keel. And I pay for yard work, and I'm trying to think all the other things I pay people for. I buy Halloween costumes now.
That's good. I was gonna ask.
Premium prices, the ones they want, because it frees up this huge amount of time but still meets their needs. So, you know, I realize there are budget constraints around things like this, but there are also time constraints. So I just sort of weigh what my hour is worth against what the cost of that thing is. And I price my time out at a pretty high rate. So I find myself very often saying, just pay somebody to do that. And
I was going to ask, you are an accountant, and so this probably comes natural to you, but how do you price it? Is it based, do you think automatically of your salary, or do you just throw an arbitrary
price? I mostly use my salary and my consulting hours to sort of price, like, what I'm willing to pay for that time. I mean, I probably figure out how much more would I have to work to cover that? And it's... You know, you really quickly say, this frees up an hour to go do this thing, so that's a lot better choice. You know, and it shows up in all kinds of places, like it costs $50 more for the flight that you, at the time you want, versus the one you don't, the cheaper one that requires all this moving stuff around. And then I start thinking about what it will cost me to get on the 6 a.m. flight. With, you know, I have to get a babysitter in the house to get the kids off to school. And all of a sudden you go, I can fly at 10 a.m. a whole lot cheaper. You know, right. The flight's more expensive, but everything else is not more expensive. Yeah, so I do that math pretty fast.
Well, I think that's excellent advice. And I think Hannah will love that advice.
It's very good advice. Just pay people to do things. Plus, it's economic stimulus. I feel right. It's very good for the economy. Yeah. I can completely justify this. One of my friends, when I years ago, like this, probably before Annie was born, his philosophy as an economist was that it's really important to pay kids a real wage because they won't value work if they don't see that work pays money, they won't want to work. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I paid my kids pretty good. So when we started paying people to babysit or people to mow lawns, I tried to make sure I paid them really well. And the perk of this is they never say no to you. I mean, you call and say, is there any way you can fit this in the schedule? And they rearrange their schedule because, you know,
it's worth their time.
Extra money. Yeah. Why would I say no to that lady? She pays me really well.
That's good advice. That's very good advice.
Yeah. Works really well. Pay for it because that's what your time's worth. So buy the hour of your time by paying somebody else to do things. It's replicable.
That it is. It's very replicable. That's great. Yeah. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. This has been great. And I've learned a lot. And thank you for sharing your insights and your tips and your story. Really appreciate it. Thanks again to Christy for her great insights on how she manages to balance her work and her family and be successful at both. I think the biggest takeaway from me for this episode is that I need to get a better grasp on how I value my time, which will lead me to make better choices and more fully optimize around the constraints that I've decided to place on myself. So that's my challenge to each of you this week. Figure out how you value your time and use that to make some better decisions. I'm Stephen Olson, and I'll see you next week on the Work-Life Balance Project. Psst. Hey everyone, thanks for sticking around. If you want to tell us about how you manage your work and your family, you can find us online at theworklifebalanceproject.com, or you can find us on Instagram at theworklifebalanceproject. We love hearing about how having a family drives you to be a better professional. Please don't forget to subscribe to our show. We'll be here every week wherever you get your podcasts. In the meantime, go spend some meaningful time with your family. See ya!